Who are the adult children of dysfunctional families, alcoholic families, etc.? I know a lot of people in the Holden community have been asking me, what are ACOAs, and having a lot of questions about who these people are, what are the troubles that plague adult children, where do they live, what kind of problems do they have, and who are these people anyway?
We are people who hit age 28 or 39 or 47 and suddenly find that something is wrong that we can no longer fix by ourselves. It may coincide with the normal life crisis, but its intensity and accompanying pain and confusion suggest that there are adult-child issues beneath the surface.
We are people who gaze at our peers on the street or at a party and say to ourselves, I wish I could be like her or him.
Or we say, if only he knew what was really going on inside me, he'd be appalled.
We are people who love our spouses and care deeply for our children, but find ourselves growing distant, detached, and fearful in these relationships.
Or we feel that everything in our lives is perfect until our sons or daughters become chemically dependent, bulimic, run away from home, or attempt suicide.
We are the chemically addicted, the sexually addicted, and eating disordered.
We are the migraine sufferers, the exercise fanatics, and the high achievers with troubled marriages.
We are the social stars who feel terribly lonely amidst a wealth of friends.
Some of us grew up in chaotic families and were weaned on alcoholism, incest, and physical, emotional, and spiritual abuse.
Some of us are especially paralyzed now because of the dysfunction we experience, was so subtle and covert that we can't even begin to put a finger on what it was that happened to us.
Some of us were compared to a brother or sister who did well in school.
Others were led to believe that we could only have worth and value if we became plumbers or doctors, electricians, lawyers, or psychologists.
Many of us were emotionally neglected because no one was physically there for us, or because they were there for us with material things, but were absent emotionally.
Some were spoiled and smothered out of misguided love, seduced to stay in the nest years after our friends had gone out into the world and begun their adult lives.
Many of us are afraid of people, especially authority figures.
Others of us frighten people, especially our loved ones, and demand that our loved ones live in our isolated worlds, controlled completely by us.
We are people who despise religion or who despise atheism.
We let others use and abuse us, or we use and abuse others.
We are people who have only anger or only sadness, or only fear, or only smiles.
We try so hard that we lose, or try so little that we never live life at all.
We are men and women who look picture perfect.
We are on emotional roller coasters, or in emotional vacuums.
We smile while slamming the kitchen cabinet shut because we are really angry. Or we slam the cabinet angrily when we are really sad.
We abuse ourselves, but take care of everyone else.
When we are unhappy, we are terribly afraid to acknowledge it for fear that someone will find out that we are human, or even worse, that we are even here at all.
We make love, but we can't get emotionally close, or we can't make love at all.
We constantly watch others to try to find out what's okay and what isn't.
We feel less than some and better than others, but we rarely feel like we belong.
We get stuck in lives our hearts never told.
We hang on to the past, fear the future, and feel anxious in the present.
We work ourselves to death for unknown purposes.
We fear God, or we expect God to do it all for us.
We get into friendships that we can't get out of.
We get hooked on things.
We project our inner conflicts onto our children.
We are embarrassed about our bodies.
We suffer as much as we can.
We sacrifice our dignity for false security.
We wish for things instead of going out and getting what we want or need.
We hope for the best, expect the worst, and never enjoy the moment.
We run away when we fall in love, or we abandon ourselves for the relationship.
We smother those we love, we crush those we love, or both.
We were sexually abused by someone when we were 5 years old, but blame ourselves, telling ourselves that we should have known better at age 5.
Some of us had a parent who was chronically ill while we were growing up.
Some of us had a parent who was mentally ill when we were growing up.
Some of us had no parents at all when we were growing up.
We are survivors who deep down inside pray that someday life will be more than just mere survival.
We are the lovers of life whose child is locked inside of us, waiting to be set free. And these are the people that even make it on the headlines of Newsweek. Life in the family that we were born and raised in, or in the clinical area we call the family of origin, is a tremendously powerful experience for all of us. And the impact of that experience isn't restricted to childhood. The way we see ourselves, others, and the world is shaped in the setting of our family. The views we develop there stay with us throughout life. At some point, most of us leave our families, at least physically, but leaving them emotionally isn't as easy. Even if you put yourself up in the Cascade Mountains, like some of us do, between yourself and your family of origin, or never return home again, you'll continue to reenact the dynamics of your original family in the new family that you establish, be that your work situation, a community, a network of friends, your church. For example, you maybe do many of the things that your parents did, even though you always swore, "I was never going to be like them." The same way that they swore they were never going to be like their parents. And on and on and on. One of the most difficult things in life is to gain emotional separateness from that powerful early family environment and to not continually repeat it or react against it. And that's what recovery is all about. To have a better life here and now by learning a different way of dealing with your leftovers from there and then. If you can look at the unfinished business of your past in an appropriate context, your present and future life experience can be more positive. I'd like you to just close your eyes for a moment and think about how you feel when you visit or phone your parents. Do you feel or act similarly to the way you did when you were living at home? How long can you last before the old feelings start? 5 minutes? An hour? 2 days? What happens to you when things start getting tense? You can last more than 3 days before acting like a teenager again. You probably don't need to be here. Most of us as adults, however, tend to act in ways we wish were more different. Some of us maybe attempt to fit in as peacefully as possible, kind of peace at any price. Or we deny our own feelings and do what our parents want and just don't rock the boat. Others make a point of being the opposite of what their parents want and expect, kind of being perpetual rebels. Others make a point of trying to show their parents how they fail as parents and work on trying to improve them. Many have just as little to do with the family as possible, emotionally distant, and rarely visit or communicate with them. This is all evidence, I think, of the power of our families in our lives. Most of us haven't learned how to be close to these significant people while continuing to feel like we're still being our own person. We find ourselves reacting to them versus doing what we do that makes sense to us in our more objective moments. Until we're able to be an independent adult with the family in which we grew up, it's unlikely that we're going to be this way with anybody else in an intimate relationship either. The same issues that end up getting dumped into new intimate relationships are the ones that we had from our family, whether that's in the marriage, children, work, friendships. Satisfying adult life is dependent upon how well we learn to deal with these forces in our family of origin. None of us really has a choice, really, about whether we deal with our families or not, because even choosing to not deal with them is a way of dealing with them. You can't be freed from earlier experiences by denying them. You also hear some talk these days about the child within or the inner child. Remember a woman from the community this summer, Sunny, used to talk and give some matins about her inner child. And she had a birthday up here, and she was one of the people who made sure everybody in the village knew it was her birthday, because she was not going to be like we were taught to be, like, don't say anything about it being her birthday, because she wanted everybody to, you know, help her celebrate. And she talked about the child within a lot. And it's that part that refers to each of that part in each of us, which is ultimately alive, energetic, creative, free, and fulfilled. It's our real self, the part that God really created us to be, who we truly are. With our parents' unknowing help, perhaps, and society's assistance, most of us deny that inner child. If it's not nurtured or allowed freedom and expression, a false self emerges, a term sometimes called codependency. We end up living life from a victim stance and have difficulty resolving emotional trauma when it happens. This denial of the child within and the subsequent emergence of a codependent self is particularly common among children and adults who grew up in troubled or stressed families, like those you heard about, chronic physical or mental illness, rigidity, coldness, or lack of nurturing were probably common. So how did all this happen? In innocence, you and I made decisions out of our need to stabilize and to survive a tumultuous early life. We must be proud of ourselves. Our decisions kept us alive. Yesterday and today is a composite of what was and what is, a composite of confusion. Let's talk a little bit about the symptoms of adult children. The symptoms that we develop as a result of what happened to us are really far too numerous to mention. Some important things, though, that we can note, that the symptoms that we develop have certain characteristics that seem to hold true for most. These symptoms are part of our denial system. Emotional denial, they serve to maintain that denial. And there are ways that we allow ourselves to live sort of one kind of life while we convince others that we have a very different kind of life inside. Denial is a key part. Secondly, these symptoms give us the illusion that we are in control, but they are in fact clear indicators that what we have really done is to give up healthy control of our lives to something outside of ourselves. And Rich will talk a little bit about more about that tomorrow. Our symptoms really all started out as a very normal response, and I want to say normal response, to some perceived life stress. When our family systems growing up had some kind of dysfunction, whether it was real obvious, like a traumatic event of death or illness, or if it was subtle, it's normal and logical and reasonable for a child in that family to protect him or herself. It's just like an infection, you know, that protects, you know, physically. Fourthly, these symptoms form as a way of protecting us from a pain that we as children had no power to remove. As children, we don't always have a lot of power in our life. The longer we protect, the more adept we become at denying our true feelings. So then our symptoms are about the denial of feelings too, shutting off the hurt and the fear, as some of you talked about when you shared your pictures a little while ago. And we might take pride in how others see us. We might appear as the real strong one or the real rebel, always doing the opposite, or the real cutie pie, whatever that image is. All the while, though, we're dying inside because we feel that no one really knows who we are. And the truth is, they probably don't. Thus, these symptoms are also about intimacy and relationship struggles. We keep our guard up. We've learned how to do that well. And as a result, these symptoms are also about shame. And we'll talk a lot more tomorrow also just about shame. About the shame of being found out, discovered, emotionally naked in front of others, and being laughed at, criticized, or rejected. Sort of the way I feel being in front of this microphone. You know, some of the symptoms that develop by children fall into the category of emotional and psychological, from depression and obsessions and compulsions and all those things. And they also fall into the category of physical. The eating disorders, the accident proneness, the chronic back pain, the tension, the migraine headaches, ulcers, colitis, sleep disorders, all of those. Because they tend to be so common for adult children, there's a few that I want to take a little closer look at. Addiction is pretty common. And we could talk about addiction in a real narrow sense, like the physiological kind, where a person is definitely physically addicted and experiences some withdrawal when they stop taking in some agent of some kind. Or I prefer to talk it more in the broad sense, that includes the work, the love, TV, spending, exercise, whatever. And just because we don't drink alcohol does not mean that we're free from addiction. You can have all the traits of an addict, the denial, the discomfort with intimacy, the need for unreasonable power and control, the inability to let go without ever consuming any alcohol. So addiction is one thing. Compulsion, another thing. Something we do that we don't feel we're in control of or we can stop. But it kind of gives us the illusion of being in control. We talk about compulsive overeating, gambling, cleaning. You might say, well, am I a compulsive gambler or am I a gambling addict? And it really doesn't matter. The label isn't important. Another common is the unhealthy dependencies. Means that the attachment we have to a substance, a job, a person, a pet, whatever, is getting in the way of our happiness or contentment. Those things that keep us from hearing or listening to our insides. Keeping us in denial. Keeping us from forming healthy attachments to friends and to lovers. A major task for all of us growing up is to learn how to become interdependent with others. Interdependent. Which means being our own person and able to maintain a clear and separate identity from others while we're still able to recognize the need for and help and support, but getting it in healthy ways. Kind of a paradox about dependency sometimes is that we might appear self-reliant and independent on the outside, but floundering on the inside. Some of you shared. Another common element is the depression. Something we all experience from time to time, and there's all kinds of it. Many long-term depressions, of course, are due to imbalances in our brain, the neurotransmitters, not getting enough stimulation, which is why they find jogging to be more effective than some of the antidepressant medications. But it's also very related to ungrieved losses of childhood. And people are discovering more and more that when people come in for, you know, treatment of depression, that's probably more significant than the physiological symptoms. We get depressed when we don't know how to get what we need in life. And we get depressed maybe to punish other people or to get others to help us. Kind of a painful way to do it. Or when we're afraid to express our anger. Another common one is stress symptoms. These are really common, the migraines, the ulcers, the colitis. It's pretty simple why we get those, because we hide out. Stuff what we believe is our inappropriate feelings. Instead of telling ourselves and others how we feel it in our bodies. Phobias, the irrational fears that keep us uncomfortable. Flying, going outside of our house. Sometimes the phobias are attached to a single traumatic event, or often they have to do with the family rules that we grew up with that keep us from overcoming it. And then there's anxiety, which is a really long list, from shaking, dizziness, fears, heart palpitations, the panic attack that somebody spoke about when they got off the boat and saw what they were going to do to get up here. That might be just normal. All of these symptoms are either biologically caused or they're there for a protective reason. I want to emphasize that. And that is, they're most likely due to a family dysfunction. I think generally it's become common to understand that symptoms are either biologically caused or they're there for that protective reason and most likely due to the family that we came from. So let's talk a little bit about families. There are many ways to describe family traits that lead to unhappy adulthood. I want to spend some time going over the basics of family systems so you can begin to get a framework for understanding what happened in your family. There's very lengthy ways to do that. Some of you might be familiar with using a genogram, which is kind of doing a family tree. That is talked about more in a book called Family Ties That Bind. It's available in our bookstore. It's kind of a fun way to really take a look at how the biblical reading tonight about from generation onto generation, things continue. They knew that already in the Bible a long time ago. But I'm not going to talk a lot about genograms. I'm going to talk about more some other things, how you can organize how you look at your family. Most of you are familiar with the way of looking at a family in terms of a system. And like any system, a family has some functions that it serves. For example, the maintenance kind of functions to get food, shelter, clothing. Providing safe, warm nurturance to its members. The ability to learn how to touch, to experience laughter, tears, share joys, etc. Another function is to have the love and belonging needs met. The family also has the function of teaching us separateness and autonomy, how to be an individual in this world, and also relate to other people in community. The family also has a function of promoting self-esteem or a sense of worth in everybody. Another big one is learning how to make mistakes and to learn and to be able to. For most of us, the family is one place where we can't ever hide the fact that we're making a mistake. Families are really usually pretty quick to point it out. The family also has a function of having fun. And then lastly, a big one for this weekend is the family has the function of teaching us about spirituality. And when we talk about that, we mean our relationship with creation, the universe, that unexplainable, or as Dave Oyen says, the non-understandable part about us and the world around us. When families go awry or get off course, very often people assume some dysfunctional roles. Some of you talked about those when you shared your pictures, who you were. There's the doer, the person who does all the tasks in the family and gets a lot of rewards for doing that. The person who's the enabler, the helper, the caretaker, the lover. The one who keeps peace. There's the lost child or the loner, the one who hides out, withdraws from the family, learns that it's safer to just stay at a distance off in a corner reading or with a headset on. There's the family hero who's out there to show the rest of the world that the family's okay, doing high achieving, being good at performing. There's the mascot, the one who keeps everybody laughing and provides entertainment for the family. And then there's the scapegoat, the person who everybody points the finger at and says, if you weren't so screwed up, our family would be just fine. Then there's the daddy's little princess or the mama's little man. the emotional and covert incest, where kids are asked or get to be the little spouse to a parent. And initially that feels good to a child, but later in life, that person then may end up getting physically or emotionally abused by others because as a child, their boundaries were not respected. It's unreasonable to expect a child to be a spouse to a parent. Another role might be the saint, the priest, the nun, or the rabbi. And I don't know when these pastors here introduce themselves as recovering. I'm not sure if this is what they mean. But those are the children who express the family spirituality. They're the one who is given the license to kind of be the spiritual one in the family. They're expected to become the priest. And they're often asked not to be sexual. I don't know if that's the case. Some of you might say, well, aren't those present in every family? No, they're not. What does exist, though, in every family are different personality types, the shy versus the robust or the gregarious. But does shy mean being isolated and alone? A shy child can still feel loved and feel like they belong, have a sense of self-acceptance and worth without being abused for that. A shy person can be a separate person without being lonely. They can be spiritual and they can have fun. What makes these roles I mentioned dysfunctional is the fact that they are roles. Healthy families don't pigeonhole us into one tiny little script. If a shy person gets loud now and then, who's going to shame her for it? We don't say, hey kiddo, your role is to be shy and quiet, so shut up, so you don't upset things. A healthy family wouldn't do that. A shy child, only a dysfunctional one would. Another way we can look at families are in family boundaries. The boundaries can be individual ones, the boundaries that are around each person, or they can be intergenerational, the ones that are around the parent and the child, or they can be the boundaries that are around the whole family. And then those families can, and then those boundaries can be either real rigid, very strong, or they can be real diffuse and very weak, too weak. Or they can be in the middle and be flexible. The whole boundaries issue has to do with how we learn to set limits. And boundaries in our family have a lot to do with whether we end up fearing abandonment and isolation. When parents end up getting emotional support from the children, then they're violating that individual's boundary. And boundary violations teach us to be victims. So what are some of the things that can go wrong as we grow up? Just as other forms of life out there need certain things to grow, to become healthy or to bloom, children need certain things too from their families, to emerge as adults with a sense of interdependence, not dependence. In a healthy family, we end up with a sense of trust and security that's inside of us. In dysfunctional families, children enter adulthood with a sense of incompleteness, mistrust, and fear inside, along with a strong need for some kind of security outside of themselves, trying to get that trust and security from something out there. And that perpetuates the power of the external, that something out here is bigger, which is sometimes why people can get real compulsive even about religion. As adult children, we seek to fill up the empty parts inside of us that never got filled up while growing up. I like to use the analogy of a cup or a glass. Imagine yourself kind of being one of the cups here, which at birth is really empty. And the goal as we grow up is to get the cup filled. We have certain needs that have to be met. If we came from a healthy family or had that opportunity, the cup was probably almost filled to the top. So when you go out into the world to make friends, you usually do that then with other people whose cup is also about that same fullness. In dysfunctional families, the cups didn't get filled. So we usually end up connecting with people whose cups are also not filled. So to maintain the illusion sometimes that the cup is filled, we might rely on outside things, like addictive relationships, chemicals, work, TV, and so on. We can look at healthy families kind of on a continuum with extremely healthy on one end to extremely dysfunctional on the other. And the average somewhere in the middle, which is about 70%. More and more as we talk about families, everyone always says, well, what family isn't dysfunctional? It's not kind of like either you're pregnant or not. Families are kind of on a continuum. Roughly 2/3 of the population probably fall somewhere within the average. On this continuum from extremely healthy to extremely dysfunctional, you'll find some or all of the characteristics that I want to talk about, depending on how functional or dysfunctional a family is. Some families will probably have a few, some will have many, maybe some of you will have all of them. As you look at the list, maybe I can do it, Rich. I wanted Rich to help me since I'm learning how to ask for help. That, but I'll talk about them. So, as you look at the list, it's absolutely normal and okay with me if you maybe say that never happened in my family,
Rich,
or feel confused, or get really mad at us or your family. If you wonder, or if you question, or if you doubt, or you feel sad, or you cry, or you want to talk to somebody, or you're just plain bored. First one, and I don't want to spend a lot of time because it's pretty all-encompassing, but characteristics of some dysfunctional families is that there's physical, emotional, or sexual abuse, or neglect, and other vicarious abuse. Vicarious abuse meaning the fact that you maybe watched somebody else be abused. Perhaps you didn't actually experience it yourself, but you maybe watched somebody else. And that may take a covert or a subtle form. Letting children into your arguments as parents. Trying to get your emotional needs met by your children, or criticizing shy children for being too shy are all examples. Another characteristic is perfectionism. And this is a result of the rule that might be in the family, which says, we want you always to be strong, always to be good, always to be perfect, and to make us proud. I have a memory myself of different times that my father went into the hospital and he would stay at my grandparents. And I was the second of five children, and I can recall my grandmother saying to me different times, now Jackie, you just go on being a good kid because your mom's got all she can handle, you know, with your dad. And the message was really, you know, it's not okay if I do anything wrong. And I saluted and did that for a while. But I think paid a price in some ways with that message. It's a real common one. And it's often easily denied and excused in a family. But it does end up producing a lot of shame. And that perfectionism or that message or rule affects everyone, even the person who's giving it. There's the obvious criticism and belittling that people or parents do, but there's also the subtle ones, the well-timed frown, the gesture. Remember, some people talk about being in church and you were able to just kind of get the evil eye and you knew exactly what that meant, or the smirk. The perfectionism in families results in a lot of struggles around the issues of control in adulthood. There's a lot of unrealistic expectations put on. Like, say you come home from a party and you say maybe to mom or dad, you know, I got really embarrassed at this party, something happened. And they go, what were you embarrassed for? And you get the message, without it being said, that we don't get embarrassed in our family. Or statements like, look at you, you're a mess. Or can't you say anything that makes sense? All perfectionistic. A third one is rigid rules, lifestyle, and/or belief systems. The compulsive, the rigid rituals that go on in families will rob us of the life of spontaneity. This is the rule of don't rock the boat. Change is not okay. Maintain the familiar and don't ask questions. A lifestyle that's neat and tidy is also empty and lonely. And we end up seeking the black and white as a result of that. And we have trouble handling the unpredictable, the uncontrollable. And it leaves us feeling scared, cheated, and manipulated. What happens in adulthood when there's a lot of rigidity in a family is there's a lot of all or none thinking and acting. Sometimes occurs in fundamentalist families or extremely religious families. Some of you introduced yourselves as recovering Catholics. I don't know what it's like to be Catholic, but in a sense you might have been referring to some of that rigidity. A fourth one is the no-talk rule that exists, keeping the family secrets. This is where you say, it's not okay to talk about or express our feelings openly or to talk about any problems because we don't have them. The way it came out in my own family is we don't air our dirty laundry in public. And we end up growing up to believe that we must handle all of our problems by ourselves, alone, in isolation. Another characteristic is the inability to identify or express feelings. It's kind of a byproduct of that no-talk rule and of criticism and control. In families, we end up denying our feelings. End up with the difficulty handling or resolving conflict as a result of that in adulthood. Fearing it, dancing around it, being threatened by conflict. Another one is triangulation. That's kind of a thing that comes out of family therapy, which involves three people. So one person acts as a messenger between two other people, victimizing people. It's avoiding honesty, and it's usually pretty powerful for the person in the middle. Sort of like when A has an issue with C, but they use B to communicate that. In my own family, my younger sister was always at odds with my mother, and I frequently ran go-between. Even when I was living about 400 miles away, each of them would call me, and I would try to tell the other one, well, I think Jennifer really likes you, and then I would tell my sister, well, I think Mom really likes you, and the two of them never talked. Of course, that gave me a lot of power in the situation, but very often then in adulthood, what happens are you end up with a lot of triangles in your life, and you might want to just take a look at how many threesomes you sometimes are a part of, and if that ever happens. Because what we end up doing then is shying away from people who don't communicate directly. We end up usually getting involved in systems and organizations where there's a lot of that goes on. And usually it might be two people who are uncomfortable dealing with a third person. And so they kind of collude in some way. Usually end up managing to recreate that same kind of communication dynamic in our work settings or friendships. The message sort of is don't address issues or relationships directly. That's the rule. Don't do it directly. Do it kind of behind closed door, or, you know, kind of behind the backs of other people. Seventh one is double messages or double binds. This is sort of the do as I say, not as I do. Depend how I felt taking the risk of talking about healthy families or how to move beyond that in front of people I've been living almost a year with and exposing myself to and feeling like this is sort of like do as I say, not as I do. Because I can't do the stuff that I'm talking about perhaps in some ways. But it's a place where we have double messages and double binds. Where the kid asks, do you love me, Dad? And he goes, sure, son. And trots off to either get totally engulfed in his newspaper or in his work or whatever. It's a double message to say I love you and then abandon. Sort of the I love you, go away. The eighth one is the inability to play and have fun. This is the rule that it's not okay to play or to be playful. What's important is the worth comes from what we do, not who we are as people. What we do, not who we are. Because to play means to be able to let go, to be free. To trust that we're okay even if we make a fool of ourselves. One of the things that's really allowed at Holden. If that's not present, there's the issue of being overly responsible that happens usually in adulthood. In dysfunctional families, play begins maybe in a healthy way. It looks initially like it's going to be healthy, but almost always ends up with somebody getting damaged physically or emotionally. And oftentimes the humor, if it is there, is used to hurt, as often as it is used in functional families, perhaps, to have genuine fun. The boundaries and the limits are non-existent. What maybe starts out as, well, let's play football, turns into, let's prove who's better than everyone else. Or let's wrestle turns into let's hurt someone. Or it's okay to flirt turns into I want to have an affair. The inability to have fun and stuff in families means that the family members have to work twice as hard to feel okay about themselves. Work becomes more important. And work is really easy in terms of helping a family define their roles and their boundaries. And it gives the illusion of security if everybody just does their tasks. I grew up in a family where my mother did a certain kind of work task on Monday, another one on Tuesday. Saturday was cleaning, you know, Monday was washing, and that was all really well defined and neat and tidy and always there. Ninth one is high tolerance for inappropriate behavior and pain. This comes from the rule, don't be selfish. That's guilt producing. It comes from learning to deny our feelings when we're little to protect ourselves from boundary violations and abuse. Maybe it comes from seeing our parents repeatedly refuse to take care of their own needs. Maybe it comes from watching self-destructive patterns of living in our parents who maybe work too much, drink too much, take care of others too much, eat too much, yell too much, lie too much, jog too much, and even play or pray too much. We end up trying to feel good about ourselves by always giving to others. End up getting in bad relationships or jobs and make a lot of excuses for that happening. The tenth one is enmeshment. It's another clinical term which just really means it's a tangled mess. It's kind of in families where it's impossible to see where one person begins or ends and another one begins or ends. In families where everybody's business is everybody else's. My problem becomes yours and so forth. And this results in a lot of fear of abandonment. You end up feeling that perhaps you're going to be abandoned if you don't get involved in somebody else's problem. Like I risk maybe alienating myself from the family if I don't jump in and try to solve everybody else's problem. Person who talked about taking on her 10-year-old brother at a really young age. Enmeshment. Everything is, you know, tangled in together. The handout that you got maybe can help you take a look at where you're at on that whole continuum, with one side being the unhealthy, dysfunctional family rules and the other ones being growth-producing ones. This has been a really quick and high dose of family dynamics. Most of this is probably not new for most of you. If you're the recovering ACOAs, I expect that you probably are. You've read all the books anyway. But perhaps maybe you've heard something in a different light or a new way. And it might also be helpful tonight when you take a look at the movie, Ordinary People, to kind of see what kind of rules were operating in that family, and when the trauma came, how did they deal with it? What were the messages given? We really talked about this stuff tonight to lay the groundwork for us to move tomorrow into what all this means spiritually for us. And what are some of the gifts that we have available to us to move beyond our past? Although you've heard a lot of pain, the hurt, the harm, the dis-ease, it's really important to be proud of our survival to this point and the decisions that we've made that kept us alive. And I hope that throughout your time here, you remember to look at that childhood picture that you put up or have somewhere, or even look at yourself in the mirror and say, thank you for not giving up. Ben, Renee, do you want to come up for a minute? Can you share? Risking and sharing then becomes a really important element. In recovery.
I gotta go
for it. Telling our story is a really powerful act in discovering and healing our child within. It's a foundation of recovery in self-help groups, group therapy, individual counseling, confession, all of those things. Our stories usually always include three parts. In the 12-step groups, we talk about it as it's what we were like, what happened, and what we're like now. Or it's the three parts of separation, initiation, and then return. Spiritually, we might call it bearing our souls, or we have a heart-to-heart talk. Grief work, which is what a lot of recovery is about, has to be shared. In telling our story, we talk about what's important, meaningful, confusing, conflicting, or painful in our life. We risk, we share, we interact, we discover, and more. And by doing so, we heal. Perhaps the most healing feature is that we, the storyteller, get to hear our own story.
You
can go first?
I'm at. Okay. Thank you, Jackie. I have to go first because I'm so anxious that if I don't, I might not be alive if I wait for another speaker. Does this thing work?
Yeah.
Can you hear me? Okay. I don't have any idea what Jackie had in mind for me to do tonight. As a matter of fact, I really didn't know I was doing anything until about 10 minutes ago. She wrote me a note and she says, you don't have to do this thing. So I decided I wouldn't do it. Then she says, be sure not to prepare. And then I get here and she says, I didn't really mean you didn't have to do it. So my name is Bud Atkins, regardless of what they said at dinner tonight. Evert. Actually, it's Everett, and I wasn't assertive enough to say that at that time. But I'm feeling better now that I've eaten. I'm an adult child of an alcoholic. I'm an abstinent alcoholic. What else am I? I'm a father of a recovering drug addict. Are there any other choices? Interesting life, interesting opportunity. We talk about spirituality and spiritual gifts. What an opportunity I've had in this lifetime. You know, to be born into an alcoholic family. And one of the reasons I'm so anxious about talking, I said this a little bit earlier, is because as an adult child of an alcoholic, or as a child of an alcoholic, you know, I don't know how long Jackie's been talking, and we've been reading these things and all these. You know, every one of them, I think, applied to me. You know, and I felt every one of them as I was sitting out there, because they're still with me, and they're still inside of me here. But what a wonderful bunch of opportunities to deal with different lessons in life. If I can continue to look at them as opportunities. Jackie says, what gifts do we have? I thank God that I'm still here. just briefly about my story. I don't know how long she wants us to talk. Once I get started, she knows I could go on for a while. It's a long story. It's 52 years old. I'm 52 years old. It's a long story. But anyhow, as a child of an alcoholic, I remember at about age 4, when I cut off the last digit of this finger, and everyone laughed about it. They were all drinking. I thought it was funny. I didn't think it was so funny. The doctor fixed it. Fortunately, it's still there. That's a gift. You see, it's still there. A number of instances like that as a child of an alcoholic. I mentioned earlier, too, about children are supposed to be seen and not heard. Another reason that I have anxiety getting up here and speaking, because I'm supposed to be seen and not heard. I'm not supposed to get up and talk to people. Now this little boy that still lives with me here, inside wherever he is, doesn't know if he can trust you people. You know, how can I get up here? I don't even know you. And I knew my mother and father, right? It was a drunk. My father was a drunk that I could count on. I knew what he would do. I knew what he would say. You know, I was so dumb. When I was a little boy, I couldn't even hold the flashlight right when we were working on the cars. You know, a little bit of inferiority in there, a little bit of insecurity in there. And that might be a part of what you hear. Let's see, never rode a bicycle. You know why I never rode a bicycle? Anybody here never ride a bicycle besides me? Probably not.
Not until I was 21.
Not till you were 21, see? My dad taught me how to ride a bicycle when he was drunk, and we kept falling over, or I kept falling over, as any young child would do. He ridiculed me so much that I wasn't going to take that damn risk again, believe me. We played baseball, he threw the ball, hit me in the nose, you know, I thought it was funny. It hurt. I didn't play much baseball after that either. A lot of things, little things like that, growing up that you've all talked about here already. There was something at age 12, I'm blocking it right now, I don't remember quite what that was. Oh yeah, I remember, it was age 10, when I stepped in between my mother and father when they were fighting. He'd thrown her up against the wall, so I thought, well, I better do something about this. You know, what do you do at age 10? Then he threw me out the door. At age 12, he came up to the bedroom because I didn't get out of bed when he called me 5 minutes earlier and slapped the bejeepers out of me, just kept slapping me. I laughed, put my hands up so it wouldn't hurt so much, and I laughed. That was the picture I showed you. The picture's over here, the smiling little boy. Now I learned how to do those things at an early age. But you know, a wonderful thing happened in my life at age 17, 18. Oh, by the way, I forgot to say, I left home at 15. I wanted to get out of there. It was too painful in that place. Talk about functional and dysfunctional families. I really don't know much about functional families, but I'll get to that in a minute. I know a whole lot about dysfunctional families because I've lived in those all my life, or most of my life at least. Age 15, I got out of there because it was too painful to be there. And age 17, 18, I found a wonderful thing, one of the most wonderful things I found in my life. You know what it was? Who knows what it was? Booze. Absolutely. What a gift. Took away all that pain, just like that. I was never going to drink, right? I lived in this misery. I was never going to be like my father. Jackie said that earlier. You know, we're never going to do those things. Well, I did a lot of things like my father after I found that wonder elixir, the wonderful elixir called alcohol. And then I did all my crazy things for 17, 18 years. I got married, been married 29 years. We're talking about intimacy. I came here to find out about intimacy. I've been married to the same woman for 29 years. I have never had an intimate relationship in my life. I don't know what it is. I mean, maybe I'm in one, but I don't know. After 25 years, I was pretty comfortable there. And after all, I'm afraid to go anywhere else. And maybe I'll find out, after all, it is an intimate relationship. I don't know. It's fairly comfortable, I know that. I know we don't do a lot of things together. I'm up here by myself, right? Or she's not here. But anyhow, maybe we'll figure that out. So I drank as an alcoholic for 18 years. Had a wife and two children. I still have a wife and two children. I thank God for that, too, after all the crazy things I did. Drove drunk. Like my dad used to do, scared me. You know, one of the reasons I didn't want to come up here and talk is because I'd rather be over there hiding in my room. You know, like I used to hide in the back of the car when my dad was driving drunk down the street. But then what, at age 25, 26, when I had two little kids, I did the same thing. I mean, I was the best driver in the world after a 6-pack or 12-pack. At least I thought I was. Okay, so enough of that. 17 years as an adult child, and actually 52 years as an adult child of an alcoholic. Another 17, 18 years of my own insanity and drinking. And then by the grace of God, I got sober at the age 35. Talk about gifts. Getting sober is a real gift for me. I started to learn a little more about what life is about at age 35. Somebody said, I don't know what it was now, but immaturity, you know, emotional immaturity, stunted growth. So for the next 12 years, what did I do? Tell me what I did. I worked with other people, right? Because, by the way, I had all this experience and I knew everything about it. And so I went out to save the rest of the world. Well, what I didn't know about that was, again, I was avoiding the scared little boy inside of here. Inside here. So I did that for 12 years, and Jackie and I used to work together. One day I told Jackie, I'm not going to do that anymore. I used to give spiritual lectures. And I said, I'm not going to do that anymore. God talked to me, so to speak, and said, don't do that anymore. Said to me, you need to learn some other things. You need to go inside. And you need to find out what that's really all about. And you need to find out about some of those things you've been talking about for 12 years to other people. So that's what I've been working on for the last 5 or 6 years. And again, I see that as a real gift. Jackie says, you know, look in the mirror and thank yourself. I'm very grateful to still be here at age 52. I said to myself when I turned 50, I said, you know, I haven't done a very good job of taking care of this temple that I was graced with when I came in. And I said to God, I said, you know, there's something amiss here, really. You know, I feel really fragmented and confused about life. And I said, will you help me to heal and help to make me whole? I don't know what that is, but I would certainly like that. I think I would like that. And so I've been moving in that direction for the last number of years now. I was sitting over there just before I came up. I had tremendous pain in my shoulder. You know what that is? That's that scared little boy in there that doesn't want to get up here and talk. That's that part that's not healed yet. And that's a part of why I'm here this weekend. To find out about some of these gifts. To find out about intimacy. And what else are we going to talk about? All these things we're going to talk about. Spiritual gifts. And how they apply to me. And how they help me to get things together here. Jackie said in her note to me, don't prepare. And I have to laugh about that. I've taken 52 years. I've been preparing for 52 years to get up here tonight. You know, I didn't want to get up here tonight, but I'm grateful that I did. And I sat up there and I thought, you know, why me? You know, each one of you could get up here tonight and tell how it's been for you and how it is for you. And I've got some notes here, but I don't have my glasses on, so I can't read them. But I think that's about all that I have to say right now. And I really thank you for listening to that. Have a good weekend.